Okay, and welcome to episode 169 of Shockwaves. I'm one of your hosts, Rob G.
69!
I was literally going to say, none of you guys snickered at 69.
Both,
instead,
Elric went right into air guitar.
Air guitar.
That's all air guitar.
Air guitar.
Elric Kane is with us, air guitaring 169, dude.
That's good. I hope everyone had a good Blood Rage day.
We did.
Yeah.
Rebecca McKendry's here. Did you Blood Rage?
I have to tell you what I did on Thanksgiving. It'll come up. It'll come up. It's crazier than Blood Rage.
All right. No Ryan Turek tonight, unfortunately. So the band is already broken up.
Yeah, that wasn't long.
We made it 1 week.
But he will be back in 3 months. He's just doing the next Halloween.
No, that's not true at all.
Where the fuck is he? He has no excuse to be here.
I think it was a work-related thing that came up at the last minute.
That's how rumors get started, Al.
But he
got scooped somewhere, and now we have to debunk it.
But he helped us get our guest tonight. He actually booked the guest, and it's going to be wonderful. I can sense it.
Ryan
will be back next week for sure.
I
can almost guarantee.
I feel
it.
Like there's always with this show lately. I feel like there's always change. I bet next week there's going to be more change. We just have to get. We got to get our ducks in a row. Okay?
Oh, Elric.
Changes.
What do we got to say? Oh, you know what? Right off the top, before we delve into movies, you inside baseballer people.
We're just giggling.
Your subtle hints at things to come.
Yeah.
I just want to send a shout out to our friend Tony Giles, who did the Damn Fine Network, the Damn Fine Cast. He actually announced that he's stopping all the podcast stuff.
Yay, but I hope he has cool stuff on the horizon.
Well, you know, he just had a daughter, so there's that.
He's got a lot of work obligations
coming up. But the point being is, and I sincerely mean this, it was the Damn Fine Cast, which was the main show, was – I think it's the first of its type. I don't know if other people are doing similar shows, but it was a great soundtrack vinyl show where he would play – stuff that was coming out from, you know, all the big labels now, like Death Waltz and Waxworks, as they were just coming up. He would play older soundtracks. He would play stuff from Jerry Goldsmith and do tributes to that. And it really expanded my – I love movie music, but it really – I mean, much like when people listen to this show, my list grows of, oh man, I got to look for that soundtrack because I didn't remember how great the music was for that. And, you know, there was a lot of other shows. There was the horror-centric one called Cuts from the Crypt, and just a lot of great content. I mean, him and I did a pop culture show called Two Dudes Talking way back when. So, I've already pointed people to that network before, but, there's tons of great stuff that's still there and you can celebrate. So I would go back and check out anything on the Damn Fine Network, including Two Dudes Talking, which I thought was a lot of fun to do. So there you have it. Thank you, Tony. I'm wearing the T-shirt for your network in your honor tonight. So thank you. Thank you for your service. All right. So who wants to talk Crazy Mutant Bears?
Oh, we're going to jump
right in.
Because
we found out that we all three watched Prophecy.
Unplanned.
Scream Factory, bless them.
Who had seen Prophecy before?
I had.
I thought I did, but then I watched it this time. And I'm like, no, I've never seen this.
See, I did back for a project that never happened. I was on as a consultant for these kind of it was an animal exploitation film back maybe 4 years ago, and it was supposed to be set up like The Long Weekend, where it was like a couple goes into the woods, they're assholes, and nature strikes back. And so I went on this binge where I watched every animal exploitation movie that I could find, or Nature Strikes Back films, and so I watched Mutant Bear Beaver back about 5 years ago, but it was nice to revisit it.
Well, it's, you know, it's a big movie, so it's a big studio movie. It's John Frankenheimer, a major director, has like this high cachet to it on one level. It's very political. It's, you know, it gets bogged down. Like I was watching with my friend Dick, and you're just like talking, and then something really explosive happens, and you're like, holy shit, this is great. You know, I think if it kind of buried some of those, if the politics weren't the kind of, if they were put to subtext, is what I'm saying, it would probably be a little more engaging because it's a little on the nose, but it is a product of its time period.
Yeah.
By the way, this is the 1979. Yeah. John Frankenheimer movie.
Not Tom McLaughlin starring.
As the bear, yeah.
As the bear.
Not the Christopher Walken 90s. One where he like sits on the edges of beds doing this.
Before we talk about it, I want you to know that in the credits, I don't know if you watch the credits, but holy fuck. So I, of course, know the Tom McLaughlin story, as do all of us, because we were there back in Killer POV. Tom McLaughlin, this incredible, the director of Jason 6, you know, tells us that he was in the bear suit, right? In the credits to this movie, the credit is mimes, and it credits four different mimes, including Tom McLaughlin. Mimes.
Wow.
They're actually credited as mimes. I'm like, wait a minute. The people in the bear suit were called mimes.
I wonder if they were hired mimes. As mimes.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I was like, but then the bear is the least graceful thing I've ever seen in the history of movies.
Do you know how hard it is to like move a mutant bear?
I know, but
Elric.
It's so tall and it moves so like grizzly is so
Look,
much more
when it attacks
natural.
The car.
Oh, dude, yeah.
It's graceful.
But it's the thing that if you ask Becca on one of these bold horror statements or futures of horror panels, that comes up every time. And I agree with you, which is the future. Future, there's going to be some eco horror, right?
Yeah, I always do talk about that. And that is like, I've been saying this for a couple of years, and I still believe that we are headed in that direction of eco horrors, more of them.
I mean, it makes sense. Yeah. Not Wendigo. What's the one that Fessenden made after Wendigo? The Last Shift?
Last Winter.
That feels like a great eco horror. But I agree. And this one was like very political, very much about the toxins from, what is it, a tree plant mm-hmm. where they treat the logs.
It's a log company. Log company's waste mutates the environment.
Yeah,
with the guy from The Thing in it. But it's, you know, so the setup is, you know, this doctor wants to change the world, and he takes his wife, Rocky's wife, which feels a little like he's cheating on Rocky, but Tali Shire is there, and they go off into the wilderness, and the Native Americans are protecting the forest. And the part that's super weird is Armand Asante is leading, and you're just like, oh, guys, like Armand Asante is like such to me, like I think of him as such a gangster Italian, like he should be in the Irishman, not in this one. But you know, whatever, he does his best.
It's
1979. Things are different. He tries valiantly to protect the forest, though, so I respect him for that. And basically, while this is happening, murders are happening in this forest, being caused by we find out later this killer mutant bear. Mm-hmm. But they are blaming the inhabitants of this forest for it, and it's, you know, so there's like a race, you know, it's kind of on the bridge of a race war in some ways in the small town. So it's got some really interesting elements, but a lot of them aren't that interesting, except for when the bear
mutant
comes.
Bear. When
it attacks, it's out of control.
There's a couple, like we all like cheered with absolute joy where somebody comes out with a sleeping bag and the bear hits. It's better than the Jason kill in the sleeping bag.
Oh my God,
it's
amazing.
It hits it so hard that it slams against and just explodes and you're with stuffing.
Like
and you're
feathers.
Like,
yeah.
That is one of the coolest things I've ever seen.
No, I watched this and it was really kind of fascinating how it all kind of came together. I watched this on the same night that I watched a documentary on Netflix on the history of the recycling programs. Mm. And it talked about how in the 1970s, the bottle industries realized that they'd been putting things in plastic bottles, and they realized that there was like it was just there for like hundreds of years. And so it was the bottle industries that actually kind of launched recycling programs, and they even made that Native American crying commercial as a way to keep people from bitching at them about stop using plastic. And so within that kind of burst of the recycling and the environmental problems that were coming to light in the 1970s, you see this large amount of eco horrors that come out towards the end of the 1970s. And this was by far one of the biggest budget ones. But it was kind of cool to watch the documentary on like where we were at that time environmentally, and then to go right into Prophecy and be like, oh, this makes so much fucking sense.
Interesting. So, but it's fun. I mean,
yeah, it's a trip.
It's a good movie.
Yeah.
With particularly fun bear carnage.
The bear is in broad daylight, and I kind of wish it wasn't.
Except the one night attack sequence is particularly good, where they're all in like a weird tunnel thing and it attacks them. But again, it's like, I think Grizzly's a much more organic.
Well, I was going to say, because we just saw Grizzly at Girdlerthon. It felt like a good compliment to that, if you will.
Yes.
Because this isn't just mutant bear. The other creatures are being mutated too. The bear is the big killer, but there's a couple other weird effect
like
things.
Weird beavers and
but Frankenheimer's like such a good, like the opening is very E.T., we kept saying, because it's like somebody running through the darkness and stuff. But Frankenheimer's just a really solid director of action. So the sequences of action to me are brilliant. It's just, yeah, it's, some of the talking languishes a bit, but I do recommend it.
Yeah. Yeah. And Scream Factory just put this disc out. So there you go.
We know it's probably Prophecy. Shockwave's approved because I think the biggest fan isn't here. I think Turk's the biggest
fan.
Really?
Yeah, oh, really? Ryan God. Loves it.
I think he's ride or die
Prophecy
for that bear.
Ride or die for Prophecy.
Ride or die for that bear.
I'm reluctantly Shockwave's approved. Okay. I gave it a, what did I give it? Like 2.5, 3.5?
I think I gave it three.
3.5 to me is a rave.
All right,
that's
fine.
Like I love the movie.
I don't know about that.
4 and up is a rave.
4 to me is like the could be one damn masterpiece. It's
I'd
brilliant.
Say 4 and up is a rave.
3.5, I really love that. 3 is like that is a solid movie, but I don't love it.
No.
2.5 is like it's okay.
You're
yeah,
far
it's
more giving than me.
2, no, it's not good.
Well, then maybe I'll change it to 3.
1.5, yeah.
You talked me out of it. No,
I think I.
But
would
it was by no means like the worst thing.
Actually, no. I know what
break.
I know what I wrote through that. I think I said this is 2.5 for the drama, 3.5 for the bear carnage. And I can't remember. Oh, no, and 5 stars for the sleeping bag death. So,
nice.
So, yes.
That is a 5-star death.
It is a 5-star death. Yeah. So, way up there. Okay, so well, we've all seen Prophecy.
So,
riveting stuff.
Y'all asked me if I blood raged, and I said, no, I did something else.
Uh-oh.
So, the day of Thanksgiving, I posted up on Instagram all of the DVDs and Blu-rays that are currently sitting on my desk as, like, my to-watch shelf. And I was like, oh, you know, this has grown so much over the fall. I haven't had time to watch a lot of stuff. What should I watch? And everybody kind of weighed in with, oh, you should get like this movie or why have you not done the Quatermass movies yet? They're in there. And somebody who knew my husband's family wrote down, why haven't you done Night Beast? It's set in Perry Hall. And Perry Hall is where Dave's entire family is from. And so I didn't even really make the connection at the time, but one of them saw this on my Facebook page, and now it's Thanksgiving Day, and his father is like, so Becky, you have this movie that's set in Perry Hall? And I'm like, oh yeah, Night Beast, y'all don't want to watch that. And they're like, no, we do, because it's his parents and his brother and his cousin, and Perry Hall is this suburb in the northeast section of Baltimore, or as they say it, Balmore. And so they were immediately like, we're going to watch Night Beast. And I was like, no, you guys don't understand how vinegar syndrome works. We don't want to do this, guys. And we ended up watching Night Beast. It was the weirdest screening ever.
So is Night Beast now McKendree approved? Is this the family favorite?
I feel like she's going to have to see it again because
so
this is a weird way to see it.
Because I spent the entire time going, is that guy getting naked? That guy's getting really naked. Oh my God, this is the longest sex scene ever. It was a hilarious movie, like for the gore and stuff. And everybody was just loving the strong Baltimore accents and everything like that. But it was a very awkward screening for me in parts. So, yeah.
You can't watch that movie with, like, parents.
But it's now my Thanksgiving movie is Night Beast.
And Night Beast is now a Thanksgiving movie.
And that means Joe Bob will probably do it next year.
Probably will.
I think so.
You think he would do it
Night
justice?
Beast, guys.
We're putting it out there
Night
that it's
Beast.
A Thanksgiving movie.
You know
movie
I love
now.
Night Beast, but I wouldn't watch it that way.
I have a feeling that if I watch it again by myself, I would fucking love it. Because this was just me going, oh my God, they think this is what I watch, like, every night of the week. And yeah, it was a trip of a movie. Though.
Sex scenes with parents. There should be a whole podcast about people like
sex scenes
like
with
doing
parents.
Like where they call in and talk about how you watched whatever. Because I just remember going to Far From Heaven, which was just on the New Beverly calendar. I remember so well taking my mom to that and being so excited. And then there was some really awkward sequence where either sex scene or somebody's discovered. And I just remember feeling so weird.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah.
It's just a weird feeling. It's like suddenly you feel like, oh, I'm on a really weird date and people are going to think I'm on a date. That's my mom. I'm not on a date. And then the sex gets weird and then I feel all embarrassed. It's just me. I think it's coming from New Zealand.
I might have told this story before. For me, when I was a kid, you know, you'd go and rent movies when you were not supposed to. And I'd always watch by myself in my room or with friends or whatever. And it was like my mom had a sixth sense. The moment that Tits came out, it was just like – a knock on the door. It's like, what? It's like, are you hungry? And it's like, no. I don't want lunch. I just want to watch this movie.
You're watching it going, yeah, I'm
there's
hungry.
Like a Friday the 13th like sequel or whatever and just
that's
like
hilarious.
Knock it. Like it, without fail, every horror movie I rented, she would knock on the door whenever nudity happened
it.
Or
well,
sex.
All I ever got was, what are you watching? And I would always say the title and then they would just
walk
on
away.
Through. And I was just, does it matter? What are you watching? Revenge of the Nerds. Okay. And then they would just keep going. And it was anytime nudity was on the screen, I always got that response from both my parents. But no one ever stopped me.
I think you're lucky.
Yeah, you're much luckier than us.
I don't know, because I watched Gothic at way too young an age.
No, and I didn't like it. I didn't like Gothic when I first started.
Are you kidding?
Oh, I really didn't like
God,
it.
My God, I fucking loved it. I understood none of it, and I was mesmerized.
I was the opposite. Like, I was disappointed because I wanted it to be something else. Like, I wanted it probably to be a Friday 13th film or whatever. I didn't like it, but I did grow to like it a lot.
Am I going
to
grow eye boobs? I want eye boobs. Yeah.
Wow.
No, I never thought
Did it happen?
Gothic might come into play later this episode.
Oh, really?
Maybe. You never know.
For those who don't look at the heading.
But I think I would likely approve Night Beast because it was, and even, I mean, like.
likely approved.
Even with the kind of awkward viewing arrangements, it was still a super fun film to watch as a group. Like, they definitely got most of it until there was a lot of nudity, and then it was just me sinking slowly down in my couch going, why did I agree to this? We should have watched Quatermass.
And, but it's funny nudity.
Yeah, it was not sexily shot. I think that's the biggest thing. Sexily shot. Like, that's the biggest thing is you can have sex scenes with people who may not look like porn stars. And that's totally fine because most of us don't look like that. And I like natural sex scenes. But this one was like broad daylight, one very unflattering angle. And it did the camera did not move. It was unyielding.
Yeah,
it was down from like ass level. So we were staring up their noses bulk of the time.
I remember once hearing an interview with Michael Caine, and they said, you know, what advice do you have for actors? He goes, just don't do full frontal. Because you could run into the scene and you'll stop, but the other part will keep swinging. And you're not, you don't want that. I just remember going, well, that's great advice.
That's a good Michael Caine.
They should have listened to that advice. And don't blink.
Wow. All right.
So that, so I watched one of yours.
What's one of mine?
I think it was towards the end of your tenure, I finally saw Harpoon.
Oh.
From this indie year. I don't remember. Was that part of your tenure?
Yes. It came out through Epic Pictures via Dread, the Dread label, and it was one of my acquisitions. And Arrow Video on the UK just put it out on disc, and they did a terrific job.
Yeah, I liked it. Like, I thought it was a good – so it's more black comedy – dark black comedy. I think for people who like films like, you know, Cheap Thrills and those that kind of subgenre, you're going to have fun with it. It's a very simple setup. A friend character is basically – well, it opens with a lot of energy. You basically have this guy who's packing up to move or something. Can't even remember. And his best friend is coming over, and there's, you know, voiceover kind of setting it up, and the best friend comes in and kind of Patrick Bateman vibes to the best friend. Yeah. He just comes in and beats the living shit out of his friend because he thinks he's sleeping with his long-term girlfriend. And so that's the setup, is just these three characters, and they say, no, I didn't do it. They decide to kind of reconnect and spend a nice day on a yachting trip.
Right.
And that's the setup. And then basically the yacht then certain things that come to light, and you start to literally have a triangle, a problematic triangle. It's very dark in its sense of humor.
They're all terrible.
And then, they're all not good people. No one's pleasant in this film. That's the thing. That's why it's great. You know, typical, almost very bad things are dark comedy. And then the boat itself gets stuck. So now they're also stuck there, and it just keeps intensifying. And there is an actual harpoon, which was going to be the birthday present for the main Patrick Bateman-ish character.
Wait, the harpoon was a birthday present?
Yes, it's a present they give him, and so now there's a harpoon in play. So that's all you need to know for the setup. But it's fun. Like, I think the acting's really good. It's I particularly liked the long-haired guy
Turbo Kid.
Yeah, I didn't
Turbo
realize. Kid. And when I realized that, I was like, oh, I really like that guy. I got to remember him.
Monroe Chambers. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's really good.
But it's a fun movie. Like, it's good. Like, it's, you know, if you're looking for those good, like, indies where it feels like a good first film from someone, you know?
I wanted to put it out for Valentine's Day.
Oh,
yeah. Because I like the love triangle thing.
Yes. No,
out now, so.
I like that kind of casting. So, yeah, that's fun. It's one that maybe wouldn't go on my horror list, even though it is horror, but it's also more, to me, it's just, you know, it's a good, solid black comedy.
Yeah. No, I really like that movie too. So this is horror adjacent, I guess, only because we're talking about Shirley Jackson. And
I was wondering, this is one I thought
she would. Down in Dark Hallway is one of my favorite books. Assuming that's what you're about to talk about.
No, I believe you said you've always wanted. Maybe I'm misremembering that you've
always lived in the castle.
Yes,
it was my dream remake.
You've always wanted to make this into a movie. Yep. I didn't realize that it got made already. I went to see some friends this past weekend for Thanksgiving, and we were looking for movies to watch. And one of them is a big Shirley Jackson fan. I was like, oh, I want to watch We've Always Lived in the Castle from 2018. And I was like, oh, they made a movie last year. And I think it's on Netflix. And it's directed by Stacey Passon, who has done some Netflix TV stuff. She did one of the episodes of The Punisher and whatnot. And fascinating cast, because the main characters are Mary Kat, Constance, and their uncle Julian, who live in a castle. And because there was some nasty business at the castle, a murder of their of the lead principals of the family, the townspeople kind of they kind of don't trust them. They think they're terrible people, whatever. They're played by Tasia Farmiga, Alexandra Daddario, and Uncle Julian is Crispin Glover in a wheelchair. And Crispin is amazing.
Oh, good. Okay.
He's actually really, really good in this movie. But it's got a very quirky, I want to say almost, it's technically could be modern day, but it's definitely got a quirky, like 50s style vibe to it. And basically what happens is a long lost cousin played by Sebastian Stan, the Winter Soldier himself, shows up gorgeous and very charming and kind of works his way into this family where a lot of, maybe their secrets start to come into play. A lot of kind of the hatred that the town has for them starts to bubble over. And really it's more of a – I guess you could consider it more of a mystery, like a very quirky, dark mystery.
Yeah.
More than a horror movie. But I was taken aback because I'd really not heard anything about it. I knew the title because Beck had mentioned it several times in the show. Again, Crispin Glover's great in it. Alexandra Daddario has got this – there's just – it's, I want to say it's like a creepy smile, but basically she's got that 50s style smiling at everything sort of vibe to it. And I've never, it's kind of unsettling that she's always kind of has this happy facade, even though you know there's some sort of repressed darkness from whatever has happened in the past. So I don't know. I just thought this is a really fascinating, cool Netflix gem.
Yeah, I've heard it turned out really, really well. And this was one of those that I was so and I think we all have these in Hollywood, the one that you're like, I should have been making that, and so you never see it. And so I kind of avoided hearing about it. I was the same way with Donna Dark Hallway, which is another Shirley Jackson one that just came out.
That got made. I never
– It did. And I haven't seen it yet either. But I keep hearing things about what We've Always Lived in the Castle, so I need to double back and see it. For me, We've Always Lived in the Castle is like reading the book growing up. It was this perfect combination of dark humor, a gothic house tale, and a murder mystery, and all embodied within two adolescent girls.
Yeah.
And so it was just like everything that I love in the world in one story.
The cover art looked like The Haunting of Hill House.
Yeah, and actually it's one of the producers. They actually sell it that way. Like on Netflix it says, from the producer of The Haunting of Hill House.
Actually, the original cover art for the book is the same one that Bava stole for Shock. It's the girl looking through the fence.
Yeah.
That's the original book cover art.
Yeah, I love that art. Wow. It's really cool.
That's cool. And Sebastian Stan is really good. Hmm. Like, again, I've seen him in a few things here and there outside of the Marvel stuff. But he is really good at this. Yeah. So
Netflix.
Yeah, We Have Always Lived in the Castle. I strongly recommend this one. Maybe it's Prime. Let me double check that really quick.
While you're doing that, seen any good theater, Becca?
Yeah. So a couple of weeks ago, Elric and I were both on Instagram, I guess at the same time, and Darren Lynn Bousman posted up about this musical theater experience that he viewed as the future of musical theater, and it looked awesome. And immediately Elric like snapped a picture and texted me and was like, you're going to fucking love this. And I was like, okay, but you have to come with me. And so we saw Cages last week, which was an amazing musical theater experience.
And very cinematic.
I'm still struggling to call it musical theater. It definitely was very small. So the whole setup of it, it's very Tim Burton-ish, and the plot sounds a little on the nose, as I've been trying to explain to people, but it's set in this kind of dystopian futuristic society where emotions cause all these wars, and so they become illegal. And so everyone's heart is in a cage, and which is the title. And even the costuming, they have these cages over their hearts. And one boy who has been ostracized and works running the clock tower falls in love with this girl, and it's like the first time that there has been emotion in this world in a very long time. And he expresses his love through song. And so the whole thing is about trying to find her and living in this society where this can't exist. And then this kind of like dystopian regime, this very authoritarian dystopian regime comes in to send them to like a rehabilitation thing.
Yeah, you can't really do it justice with story because the story is
it
is
sounds so,
much so
on the nose.
It's just more the experience. I'm not a big musical theater guy, but it's one the one thing that threw me probably is just that it's really only one person who really sings.
It's one main actor. Like there's a couple, maybe six others that drift in and out, but it's one main actor that
but
on stage.
The interplay with the visuals is like nothing. I've never seen anything like this, where it's all front, rear screen projection, multiple layers, text jumping on screen.
Interacting with the screen.
Yeah,
like,
it's
they
pretty
will
incredible.
Do something, and there'll be times when you won't know if you're looking at the screen or someone actually on stage because they'll blend together, and you don't realize it until like somebody will move away, and then you're like, oh, that was a real person.
Yeah, it's got a Rob's pulling up. There's like a trailery thing online if you want to look it up, but I think the run will be extended, but definitely I recommend
it. It.
Yeah, it's just an experience. It's like the whole – what's cool about it and why Darren I think likes it so much because he's into experiences that are
this
mixing
is
different
an experience.
Genres. Yeah.
Yeah, this is definitely an experience. It's not like musical theater like you would go see Sweeney Todd and they're moving sets around and it has acts or anything like that. It's hyper surreal. There are times where the plot kind of is superseded by emotions. And so you'll take these kind of psychological, almost like first person journeys, with the protagonist as they go through psyche and how they're feeling. And you'll do that for 15 minutes with these like incredibly intense, surrealistic visuals. And then it'll come back to the plot. Yeah. And, so it's really intense. Yeah. There was some amazing visuals in it.
Like, yeah.
I can't even imagine how they did all that. It was literally like watching a movie with one actor interacting with it on stage for the bulk of it.
So yeah, if you can make it or if they tour at some point, which they probably will. I mean, it looked, let me put it this way. It did not look cheap. It looked it looked like they made an entire movie and then also brought it into live theater and then layered it because
it
did not feel
cheap. I would
say
even more than a movie because so much of it was animated and like knowing from working with the animation students at USC, animation is so much more intense than like making a feature. And this was feature film. The whole thing, a lot of the screening had this very kind of German expressionistic silent film vibe going on with it. Like it definitely leaned into horror without ever becoming full horror. It felt very much like a gothic Frankenstein tale without ever really kind of going there. So
yeah, German expressionism is probably actually the closest description. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're right. But it's really cool. Yeah, I was saying original, and it's fun to kind of mix up our cinema going with these weird experiences.
So shortly after that, I watched Mary, which is just came out recently. This is the one with Gary Oldman and Emily Mortimer.
What could go wrong?
Well, this was not my favorite film of the year. I really wanted to like this because it's an aquatic horror. It's like it's literally a ghost on a boat. Like Gary Oldman.
This was kind of a big budget one. I remember hearing about it.
It has to have been huge. I mean, the cast is amazing. The setups are amazing. But honestly, this one just fell kind of flat for me. The setup is that Gary Oldman runs a fishing tour company in Florida. And they're struggling financially. And he goes out to buy another boat. And instead decides to buy this like vintage ship that is very much like one he used to have when he was a kid. And he wants to completely renovate the boat and sail it to Bermuda with his family. And just kind of do this like, you know, we have no money. I don't like what I'm doing. Fuck it all. I'm just going
to
sell everything and buy this boat. And they do.
That's
and
so
they
close
start. No, right? I feel you. But so they start renovations and they don't really know the history of the boat. And they don't even really look up the history of the boat until they're like hundreds of miles out to sea and weird shit starts happening. But then really weird shit starts happening and you realize that the boat's haunted. I wish that the ghosts, the scares were more orchestrated. That was the biggest thing that kind of put me off is that these scares were just not orchestrated as well as I wanted them to be. Acting was great. Gary Oldman was great. Emily Mortimer was great.
Why did he do that right after winning the Oscar? I wonder if it was made before he won because he won the Oscar only like what, 2 years ago? That's a weird. Anyway,
yeah, I don't know. I'm trying to get to. I mean, it's directed by
Michael Goy,
who's primarily a cinematographer,
mm-hmm. and it was beautifully shot.
Yeah, he shot the Town That Dreaded Sundown remake.
Oh, that's
yeah.
good looking.
And it is gorgeously shot because it's all this water imagery on the boat. It's raining half the time. And I mean, I can't even imagine filming because they're shooting in this tiny little boat with cabins and things like that. But he brings his two daughters along, and one starts kind of channeling the ghost. And as much as I wanted to love this because of the aquatic heart, it felt a little overdone to me. Like it was things I'd seen before. That said, I could just be completely fucking off base, because when I later looked it up online, I saw all these reviews of like, this was great. So
no, I had a friend who saw it at Fright Fest and was like, it was a turkey.
Yeah,
so it I heard kind of
really good setup, but just as soon as the scares happened, it lost its steam for me. I was so in for the setup, and then as soon as the first jump scare happened, I was like, "What the hell was that?" It wasn't anything. So.
Sounds like Ghost Ship to me.
No, yeah. Ghost Ship, I love.
No, the first 20 minutes of that's great, and then it goes.
Oh, that's what I will watch Ghost Ship anytime just for the rat poisoning, disemboweling fishing line scenes.
Yeah, that stuff's gold.
So. Yeah.
So that's a lot of boat movies. I just realized we had Marion Harpoon.
So that was Mary.
You know what doesn't have a boat?
What?
Mortuary.
Oh, which one?
I don't know.
That's not the torpedo.
All I know, this is actually pretty funny. I watched Mortuary a few days ago, and just now when we walked in the room, I was like, what the fuck happened in that movie? Like, I swear I had a cinematic blank, and then I realized, oh no, all you need to remember about this movie is that Bill Paxton, very young Bill Paxton, very pervy, weird Bill Paxton, is working for a mortuary guy. He's the son, and he is a super creep, and he dresses up in a black cloak and threatens the girl throughout the story. There isn't really
a story. This is the 1983 one.
Yeah, this is an 80s film. There isn't really a story. You know, her dad in the opening scene in slow motion gets killed by a pool. They say it's suicide. She believes he was murdered, so she starts having these nightmares. And then her boyfriend and her boyfriend witnesses this weird kind of devil ritual. And then really just Bill Paxton starts menacing her. And I think it's meant to be a surprise that Bill Paxton's a killer, but it's like there's no way you could be surprised by it. It's quite fun, like for an 80s film. It's just like in terms of story, I cannot literally for the life of me, and I just watched it. So it has both Susan and Christopher George. So if you see Susan George from Pieces, Bastards, 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 you know Christopher George can't be far behind. And he's the actual mortuary, so Bill Paxton's dead. But it was fun, and it was like it popped up on – where did it pop up? I think on Amazon finally. It's one I had wanted to see because it was part of Brian's all-nighter, Bev all-nighter from Pure Cinema, and it's just one I hadn't seen before. So great cover. It has the hand coming out of the
– Code Red and Scorpion did a Blu-ray of this, which is now sold out and out of print.
Oh, okay.
But if you're saying it's on Amazon, that's cool.
But, you know, for Bill Paxton completists, get in there.
Mortuary from 1983. Yeah. Let's see what else. So I finally watched, in anticipation of our top 10 of the year, I finally had to sit down and watch It Chapter 2.
Now,
which
I loved
I
this.
Missed
did
in
you guys,
theaters.
Did you love it?
I'm leaning towards love it. Yeah, for sure. I absolutely acknowledge the thing that scared me away, I think, was really a few things. The running time, which is almost 3 hours.
Yeah.
And Irishman's, I called my beer.
But yeah, exactly.
And I
you
got
know
three
what?
And a half
I,
hours.
And I saw
what was Dr. Sleep?
No, it's about two and a half.
They just keep building on that.
But I didn't know that Dr. Sleep was going to be that long, and it didn't matter. It went by like that.
I agree, because there was a lot of very compelling stories that you weren't really.
And Irishman, I did go see on the big screen, and it didn't feel like it at all. And that's three.
That one I watched on Netflix and loved seeing it at home, just sitting there and watching. It was great.
Yeah. Anyways, back to it.
Okay.
Well, it's not just the running time. The running time was a big deterrent because of obviously trying to find the time, but also, to be quite candid, like I rather like the first movie, but I don't love it as much as everyone else does. I have a great deal of affinity for the 1990 movie. And I love the novel, and I'm not crazy about the second half of the story. Like the adult story in every iteration is not nearly as strong as the story of them fighting it as kids. And so I don't know. There were all these factors that kind of played into why I missed it. And look, it's going to be out in 2-3 months anyway, and here we are. So I knew I'd be able to watch it digitally and just rent it. But yeah, I avoided all spoilers. The thing that I thought was so brilliant about the TV adaptation is for TV, you just have 7 breaks for commercials. That's just the way they kind of orchestrate everything, and you have 7 characters. So the way that they did the TV one where it's literally the adult getting the phone call and then thinking back to their childhood, commercial. Next adult. I just think that's such a brilliant way to tell that story. Mm-hmm. And the book is pretty similar in that way too, in that you're kind of going back and forth. So I was curious about this and pleasantly surprised by how quickly they got the phone calls out of the way and just focused on them as adults. The casting of the adults is so fucking spot on in every possible way. Like I was like shocked how much they all looked like their younger counterparts, how great they were. The guy from Sinister, James Ranscone, is that his
Ranscone.
Name?
Yeah, he's so good.
And he was in Ty West's Western, in the Valley of Violence. He's great, and him as the adult Eddie is great. Freaking Bill Hader.
Bill Hader
steals.
That's the star of the movie.
He's amazing.
Movie.
He's so fun to watch in this.
And what's cool too is also diving into this after. So Bill Hader, obviously. Big comedian. You've seen him in a lot of comedies. Was on Saturday Night Live. And then he does this HBO show, Barry, which is so
dark.
Freaking good.
Yeah.
And it's funny, but he's one of those comedians that you could tell there's some darkness behind that.
Yeah.
And so Barry like captures that perfectly. Now here he is as Richie, who is not only hilarious, but also hiding a secret, which I thought was a really interesting way to play that character.
But they bring it out well through the costuming.
Nightmare on Elm Street 2 shirt, exactly as that character was,
that's
Jesse.
And it wasn't never on the nose and never spoken about. That's all done until the very end. It's very interesting.
I thought it was done beautifully. Yeah. And anyway, so the whole point being is that, yes, I rather love their adaptation. I still think they didn't land the ending perfectly.
No, like, it gets too big.
It should have ended like 20 minutes before. Like there's a moment where I'm like, yeah, this is where they should end it right now. It's really hard to complete that story with, you know, the more you analyze it, the more the, you know, I mean, technically it could have killed them at any point. You know, it's the thing. It's like he's this creature that feeds on children and it's like he sees these adults. I don't think they got the point across as well as in the novel and the TV movie that he's weak and scared of them and them coming together is kind of what, you know, he wants to try to break them apart. But all that I said, I have such a love and affinity for the characters and seeing these new interpretations of them kind of pushed me more in the love side of it.
And something I wish we would do on our show at some point because we always do our top 10. But what you realize sometimes also it'd be fun to do top 10 like horror sequences of the year.
Oh, yeah.
Because that – like in the case of The Strangers a couple years ago, right?
Yeah, that sequence.
The film wouldn't have made my list, but that
total
scene might have been my number one scene.
The pool scene was amazing.
In this case, not spoiler, I don't know if this will make my top 10 for just personally, even though I really enjoyed the actor watching it. The sequence that it was in the trailer, but it's a much longer sequence of what's her name?
Jessica Chastain.
Chastain with the old woman, I think is probably
pretty
the
great.
Best. I think it's the best horror sequence of the year. Like, it was so good and scary and like atmospheric. And you only see a little bit of it. They show quite a bit on the trailer, but there was more. There was so much more
it
to
went
that
on
scene.
For like 20 minutes.
Do you want to know what my beef is with that scene particularly?
Yeah.
And I don't, you know, people can probably call me out on me mentioning this in other movies. The reason I don't find that scary is because the scares are happening, but the character that you're following doesn't know they're happening. It's like
she starts to sense by the end of the sequence.
No, it's all happening behind her back, and it's like, and I was.
Oh, but then at a certain point it comes.
Well, at that point.
But that part was scary. That was a good jump.
Being, I always have a weird thing about like
they're not experiencing the horror, but you are the audience.
Yeah, and it's like, all right, they're not experiencing. So am I supposed to be like freaked out by like, yeah, it's kind of freaky, the little lady. Now, in that regard, I completely understand like the strangers coming up behind. You know, Liv Tyler in that room being scary. I don't know. There's a difference to me. I can't even. I guess because that's a real thing. Like the idea of somebody being in the room with you, but somebody like kind of flashing and like, you know, naked in the background. If I didn't see it, I don't know why I would be scared of
it. I think the idea is that you're scared for the character. There's two types of identification, the one where you feel it through the character and the one where you're worried for the character. So there's just not enough of that for you. I just, as a sequence, and I'm talking also about like directing, in the way where when we watch James Wan films now, and now Flanagan, I'd say, we're seeing these like, when people call them masters, a lot of it's because they're the best craftsmen out there right now, the people who are actually like know how to put a movie together better. And that's the sequence where I was like, okay, Machete has those similar chops. I think, unfortunately, that he eventually gets drowned out by like technology and effects and just big things.
Cool digitization.
But that sequence, I was like, I want to watch that sequence again. Let me put it that way.
I liked the Chinese restaurant better in this updated
CG creatures.
Liked it. I liked that they were able to go more crazy with it, that it wasn't just, you know, a single claw popping out of a fortune cookie,
that
they were able to, you know, kind of blow up the world a little bit more.
No, it is cool. It's definitely cool, but that, it always feels a bit more John Dies at the end to me when I get a part
And I've heard they spent like their CG budget was on par with a superhero movie.
Wow.
And you could see it. And also, like, I will say this, the chapter two, I watched it digitally, but it came with all the special features, and there's pretty good documentaries, both about the first one and the second one, the overall of doing it. And there's some great stuff in there. The second one, I was pretty surprised how much CG Pennywise there was as opposed to just putting – I mean, I'm sure Sarsgaard was in the makeup for a lot of it. But they show him doing like face capture stuff, and he is way more terrifying doing Pennywise without any makeup because he's kind of like young and good looking. And then like his eyes start like drifting. Like he does that eye thing for real.
Oh, seriously.
Like, one of his eyes can like drift back. Okay. And then he does the smile, and the smile is totally real, and he drools for real. So like when you see him doing it without makeup, I think it's got – I actually did an Instagram video because I'm like, look at this fucking lunatic.
Now
like,
I have to find cool that. Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
I'll dig it up again. I'm sure it's online as well, but it's that. And again, I will never get over. I think it's part of the reason we love, you know, reading like Fangoria and stuff is I'll never get over that fun making of process and seeing like how a character like that comes to life and just getting that little glimpse of like, oh, that's so
cool.
Well,
that's why the person matters so much. That's why Robert Englund is Freddy Krueger.
Oh, yeah.
Like 100%. The people who play Jason never mattered quite as much because the mask is a big part of it.
For sure.
But man, you know, you can't, the physicality and the facial expressions are huge.
Yeah.
Overall, I'm glad you finally saw it.
Yeah, thumbs up for it too, even though I recognize that it's not a perfect movie. But I think overall they did a pretty good job with adaptation. Yeah. So. Anything else?
I saw Knives Out. Not horror, but super fun. Highly recommend
The most fun I've had in a cinema this year.
Wow.
Yeah.
Like it's not,
really good.
It's a one – for me, it's the kind of film where I only will watch it once because it's all about twists, you know, and then when I get that information. But the performers are great. And just if you like Agatha Christie and this kind of you know, murder mysteries, and Rian Johnson, top form to me. It was so much fun. And just – yeah.
Yeah.
Not cool. Really hard, but you know, there's a murder.
There's a murder.
In court marks.
Sort of counts.
I got a big one that I'll lay down before we go, you know, because we are going to be on the verge of doing our top 10 of the year. This is a film I heard about at when the Cannes reports were happening a few months back. Maddie Diop is an actress who was in a Claire Denis film before she made Trouble Every Day. She was in one called 35 Shots of Rum. Or maybe it's right after, actually. It's after. She was in, and her father, her uncle was a Senegalese filmmaker, and her father was Senegalese, but her mother was French, and she you know, kind of was acting and doing some filmmaking. Well, her feature debut is like the knockout movie of the year, as far as I'm concerned. To me, it's called Atlantics.
Oh, and, my God!
And it came out the day. It was basically a movie I thought I was going to have to wait months and months to see, and I'd been like charting going, when am I going to see this freaking movie? I listened to the Film Comment podcast. They're all raving about this movie. I'm like, when am I going to see this movie? And it's like, it's dropping tomorrow on Netflix. And I was like, ah!
What?
And I was so excited.
Oh my gosh, I've heard so much about this because it's like sci-fi.
Well, no, it's not. It's not aquatic. It's just
isn't
her.
Isn't it about a building collapsing and a civilization collapsing into the sea?
No, this must be a different one. Probably, with that title, that would make sense. Now, this is... this is just – it's so – I love – you know, you'd watch this. Let me put it this way. This would be a movie that Rob would watch and go, hey, Eric, this is your movie. You know, it's –
I put it in my queue when I saw you tweet about it, for sure. Yeah.
So basically it's shot almost like near realist vision of basically these Senegalese men are all working on this building site, and they're all owed 3 months of pay, and the guy isn't paying, and there's these beautiful towers, and they have nothing. We have 3 months of back pay. They're not being paid. At night they go to this bar and kind of hang out with the girls who also have nothing, and it's just shot complete realism. You wouldn't know there's any genre trappings whatsoever. And even then, I would have just kept watching that film because it's like I've never seen that part of the world, to be honest, on film in this way. And the guys decide to they don't tell their girlfriends, but that night we don't follow them. We stay with the girls. This is all a woman centered point of view movie throughout. The guys have gone off on a ship and tried to make it to Spain to try to get, you know, out there and to make money, but. Probably you don't really necessarily know what happens to them, but what becomes very clear is all their girlfriends in kind of the second half of this film at night basically are all possessed by the spirits of those guys and then start going to the person who ripped them off and saying, you know, you have to bring us money, and their eyes are white. So it's basically a mixture of a ghost story and I think it's coming from the jinn, a jinn tale because of the, you know, the Muslim religion there. And it's done in such a, like, we're not a horror film. It's definitely like, you know, this is an art film.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's on the rating system here on Google. It describes it as a romantic drama.
Yeah, it's not. I mean, it's weird to talk about, but there's a horror thing I have. There's a couple moments in this that use a similar device of where you see one thing in the mirror and you're seeing one thing in front of you. It's so good. They do it so subtly, but this is a full-on ghost story. Like, that's not questionable, whether you think it's hard horror or just like that kind of, but as a ghost story and even a love story, a love ghost story, I was really impressed. This is honestly the most impressed by any movie I was this year that is not by a director who's already, like, all the films I've been most blown away by were by Tarantino, Scorsese, all these people this year, Ryan Johnson. This is someone who's never made a feature, and this movie is just so smart. And it actually reminded me, I was going to post, but I was going to wait till more people saw it, a side-by-side with I Walk with a Zombie by Turner, because it's actually the Val Luden film. There's imagery that's very similar, like of a person walking through with white eyes through the darkness. It's just kind of got that hypnotic quality, but this will be in my very high in my favorite films of the year, just in any list. And it's always fun when it's just something you know nothing about. Like, I just heard about it, this little inkling, and I feel like because of Netflix, it's probably going to get seen by a lot of people in the long run, which is cool.
Yeah.
Highly recommend, before you finish your years, all those people out there who do take this stuff in, to check this one out.
Atlantics.
Cool. Yep.
Yeah, I can't wait. All right, anything else?
I think that's it. I mean, there's a guest literally knocking on the door.
Who has worked with everyone.
And he's worked in different centuries.
Awesome.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. Let's do this. Okay, welcome back. And we're very excited because right now on Hulu, you can watch the latest Into the Dark episode. And it's actually a really fun movie called A Nasty Piece of Work. It is, in fact, a nasty piece of work. And we have the star of this film with us today. Very excited. Julian Sands is here. Hello.
Hello. Hello to you.
Thank
hello
you.
To all you listeners.
Oh, this is wonderful.
Yeah,
for us.
Thank you
treat.
So much for joining us.
My pleasure. It's this is the most intimate and comfortable I've been in the Blumhouse production offices.
We'll take that.
Uh-oh, it makes me want to ask follow-up questions, but I won't.
And, well, let's dive into the new movie first, and then we can go back a little bit. Into some of your filmography, but Nasty Piece of Work, I refer to it as kind of it reminded me of Swimming with Sharks, that movie from, when was that, the 2000s?
That would have been like 2000, Frank Whaley film, yeah. Early 2000s.
Basically, your character is the boss of this company, and it's Christmas time, and you're not such a nice boss. There's two executives that really want to move on up, and perhaps you pit them against each other for your amusement.
Well, it's
so
party games, but you explain it so well, I don't really need to be here. But this boss invites two employees to his house with their wives and announces that there's one promotion available to one of them, but the one who doesn't get the promotion will become expendable. And it's a question of, do you want to play my games? And his games become more and more outrageous and subversive and strange and kinky. But throughout, there's this fantastic, crazy humor that the writer brought to the script, and which Charles, the director, brought out in the scenes. It's very entertaining. It's not typical of the series, which are, tend to be, from what I've seen, full on dramatic genre work.
They're scary,
but this is an entertainment. It's funny, but things certainly go bump in the night.
So, tell us a little bit about the shoot. Was it shot here in Los Angeles?
Incredibly and exotically, it was shot here in Los Angeles, because generally LA generated work is not shot here.
No, not at all.
So, it was filmed in a house in Bel Air, so it's,
fancy.
On location in Bel Air. Wonderful, which lent itself to the story and to the games, and became a real character in the piece in good Gothic tradition. I walk to work every day because I live not so far away, and I mean, a tremendous thing to do. And of course, Blumhouse were thrilled that it was saving a little bit of a transpo budget.
That's phenomenal.
Sure. So the film is I call it darkly delicious. It is very funny and it was very surprising what kind of film it was. But for you, what was I don't know if you've ever played a character quite like this. And you can correct me if I'm wrong. So what was your reaction to I don't know if you read the script first or met with the director, but to tackling this character yourself as an actor?
Well, I was sent the script with an invitation to play the role, and I found them. Material, dark, delicious, delightful, and I thought this is a wonderful ensemble piece. Really, we mustn't forget the wonderful Molly Hagen and Angela Sarayan, Dustin Milligan, Kyle Howard, and Natalie Hood. It's not Natalie Hood. It's Natalie Hall.
Natalie Hall.
Apologies to you, Natalie. Natalie Hall, who and we were all together in pretty well in every scene. So it was so important that there was a tremendous collaboration and empathy between all the characters and the applicants for the jobs. And Dustin and Kyle were very willing. Straight men to the crazy gothic situations they found themselves in, so my reaction was yes, there's no reason not to do this, so a thrill to be involved. Then I think I met Charles before we started shooting, just to make sure we were on the same page about who the character could be. Mm. And, you know, like a kind of Baroque villain, there's something a little heightened about him. Mm-hmm. But he can't be completely pantomime because otherwise it's not grounded. Plausible. Yeah. It's not credible. Yeah. So it's grounded in, I think, a very authentic study of corporate mavericks who have too much money and too much imagination, mm-hmm. too much fantasy.
Sure.
And probably not enough sex.
That is the butt end of a lot of jokes in this from the your wife character. In terms of I'm drawing a blank.
That's all right. We're with you. I can fill in the...
Please help me fill in my own blanks. I was going to talk about obviously the character you play. Like, the film industry is different from the type of boss you play, but were you pulling from anybody in real life? Have you ever had experiences with somebody that was the boss like this?
You know, actors, when you get a script, there's three eyes. An actor has three eyes. First eye is for intelligence, which is what allows you to read the script, have a conversation with the director, do your research, observe those who might have an influence on the character. Second eye is for imagination, which is to fill in all the blanks that the script might allow and which the director hasn't addressed or what you feel might be appropriate. The third eye is the instinct, which binds the intelligence and the imagination. And when those three eyes come together, you find the character, which may or may not be based on any person living.
That was a very articulate way to avoid naming anything.
But you weren't thinking of Jason Blum, were you? Come on.
We weren't going to label it that way.
No.
I'm just curious, in general, as an actor, and obviously with a career like this and working with so many incredible filmmakers, how much is the people behind the film versus the material? I know it's all of these things depending on the project, but for you, your career, what has it usually been the draw of who's making the material or the material itself, the character, the freedom?
It's a combination of the material and who's involved, because they're the hallmarks of what might be possible and what kind of experience you might have. And I've been incredibly fortunate to work with such a wide and diverse group of auteur directors of staggering ability, talent, creative energy, and that is very galvanizing to the actor. So other things come into consideration, but the principal consideration is the script and who's directing.
And do you like take, I mean, obviously you do subconsciously take something from each project or each director or each experience, especially when you're first starting. I'm thinking for young actors out there, you work with somebody like a Ken Russell for the first time or The Killing Fields, which is, you know, the film I saw super young. Mm-hmm.
I made it super young.
Yeah, no, that's what I'm saying. You're just jumping in and I imagine each one is a lesson in a sense.
Yeah, you're not taking these things subconsciously, it's very consciously, and as particularly as a young actor, where you're trying to, find out who you are, and feeling too that you have to act. In a way that, as you mature as an actor, part of that journey is learning how to simply be comfortable refracting the character through oneself, rather than having to invent acting, and having that confidence is it takes a while. I mean, I think I left drama school when I was 21, even though I did a lot of work and some of it was okay. I think it was probably 40 before I felt really comfortable and confident, competent as an actor, and could call myself an actor, unfazed by the challenge of having to act. And then the great thing is you start to really relish it and love it. And by the time you get to the age where your friends in civilian jobs are retiring, things just start to get interesting. And you can really enjoy.
Yeah. You mentioned that you'd left drama school when you were 21. How old were you when you first knew that you wanted to pursue acting? What was the first bug that bit you?
Well, I think it was about 4 years old. And in the village pantomime in the north of England. Pantomime is something which isn't really tradition here in America, but in England, every holiday season, December, January, the village, the community put on some sort of crazy fairy tale, Cinderella, Sleeping Beauty, Aladdin, and it's embellished with all kinds of Monty Python-esque humor. I mean, cross-dressing, heightened characters, and they're always stock jokes and lines, and they're a sort of part of British culture and tradition. And I was so in the village pantomime when I was 4 years old, I do remember the line I had, which was, and I probably had a northern English accent then, my master, the famous Ali Baba, as I introduced him into the scene.
That's great. So your calling was young.
Yeah, well, it wasn't because, and then as I started to watch wonderful. I liked film very much. I loved Hammer Horror. Peter Cushing, Christopher Lee were iconic. But I loved Olivier in the films that he was making. I didn't see him on stage. But his film of Richard III, I remember I was 8 or 9 and think, God, if a person can have that much fun being evil, that's what I want to do. And then at high school, I was involved in all the productions. And was lucky to go to drama school, but everybody at drama school, they seemed so much more gifted, so much more beautiful, handsome, confident, majestic. I felt really like a troll. And when I left, I thought, if I'm competing with all these people, I've got no chance. But it's about tenacity. That's the thing that, or you can have all those other attributes, but unless you really want to be a performer, it won't happen because there are too many obstacles. There's too much discomfort you have to be prepared to tolerate. And I think within 5 years of my class of 28, there were only two of us who were still working as actors.
What was the first breakthrough film? Because obviously the stage is a big tradition there. But
well, it was, and I anticipated a career in classical theatre. I mean, that was my ambition. But I got very, very interestingly involved with something called the Filmmakers Co-op, which was an independent setup in London who always needed actors to come and be, you know, dark shadows or profiles, or I mean, it was pretty avant-garde. And I met independent filmmakers there who were doing such interesting work. I thought I'd love to be involved with this medium, and I worked as an extra. I signed on for the extras agency, which was kind of, if they'd known I wanted to be an actor, it was verboten. Right. I would never have been allowed in because they saw it. And then one day I got an agent who'd seen me in a play, and I got called for both a one-line role, but I also got called to be an extra in the same scene. And so I was rumbled by the extras agency and disqualified. But and of course, the one line was cut out of the film. Yeah. Anyway. But, I knew then to become what I said, competent, confident with film acting, because we hadn't sort of done it at drama school. I knew I had to stay available for it, and therefore not to sign up for long runs in the theatre. And I suppose The Killing Fields was, I'd done some television, interesting television work in England before, which was shot on film. But Roland Joffé gave very open auditions because he wanted to find new people to play this group of journalists in Cambodia. And he asked me to join his ensemble, and the scope and the breadth and the impact of that film was such a punctuation mark of respectability that I was offered other things, and then Room with a View made
James
a big impression
Ivory, right?
With James Ivory. Yeah.
But were you, I'm always really curious when you're trained for the stage, and especially now everyone can make films and digital equipment, but then it wasn't. It's something you had to work your way up to.
Yeah.
Without experience on screen, but jumping right into feature films, how quickly did you actually learn the craft, or do you feel like you still didn't fully understand the relationship to camera at the start?
I was guided by very good people, and your instinct sort of kicks in, what I said, intelligence, instinct, intuition, imagination. I was learning on the fly, and really that learning, you know, I'd say 15 or 20 years to become totally sort of comfortable in my skin on a film set, although I was often in my skin on film sets up to that point. And the thing is, today, you know, I feel in some ways more excited, more curious, more enthusiastic about going to work than I did when I left drama school. Because when you leave drama school, you're so loaded with distractions, like, you know, what are other people doing? What's the next job? Will there be a next job? As opposed to, you know, money comes, some celebrity comes. That brings a lot of baggage with it, which as a young person, it's very easy to become, have your head turned, you know. And it's such a relief to get to what I would call a plateau of comfort in oneself and therefore in one's work, which allows for to be unrepressed by distraction is what I would say.
Now, just 2 years after Killing Field, you get cast in Gothic, Ken Russell.
Yes.
I would love to know everything about that shoot. Just literally, you can start at the moment you met Ken Russell and just go through everything.
I was saying before we started to how I start too
building,
early.
Falling down. So did I. Yeah,
far
I saw
early.
It way too early.
I love Ken Russell. I liked his films were so exciting to me when I'd seen them at and I'd written to him when I left drama school saying, you know, dear Mr. Russell, should you ever need an ingenue, I'm and of course I never heard back. But 5 years after that, he was casting his Frankenstein story, Gothic, the great weekend of Keats, Shelley and Mary Shelley, and asked me to play Shelley.
And had he seen you in something for that, or you don't?
Well, I think he'd seen me in Room with a View because his producer insisted that he did, and he was so derogatory about Room with a View.
It's not his kind of cinema.
Not his kind of cinema. He was, and I've said if James Ivory was a sort of a miniaturist, a watercolor artist, then Ken Russell was a graffiti muralist. Yeah, he had that explosive imagination and energy, but he also had extraordinary sensitivity. He was known very much, Sturm und Drang sort of, but he wanted to be a dancer more than anything else. He wanted to be a ballet dancer. So he brought to his filmmaking the kind of athleticism which dancers require, and yet, extraordinary grace and aesthetic beauty too. And I loved working with him. It was crazy. It was difficult because he was an oligarch. And
now,
Rebecca,
did he explain? I have many questions about Gothic because, again, I saw it at a very young age, but and grew to love it and understand it on different levels every time. Did he explain the movie while he was going on? Because there's so much of it it's very Ken Russell. It's very surreal. You can tell that some of these things exist in his head, like eye boobs, for example. But there's much of it is so just surreal and visualistic. Did he explain kind of what the symbolism was behind it at the time, or just
not for our benefit?
Go with it.
No. You had to just go with it. And he was like this sort of crazed leader, and you either followed him or you fell by the way. And he would only explain things if your level of incomprehension required it, and he did so begrudgingly. But but I'd seen his work, and I sort of really dug him. So when he said to me, get your clothes off and go up on that rooftop. This was before the days of what they call health and safety now. There was no safety meeting on set. Yeah. That was a real rooftop.
Yeah. Oh, my
gosh. And then he said, right, spread eagle, get yourself stretched. Yeah, get your ass tight. And then they started with a hose pipe. And that, the drop-off from that roof was fatal. There's no question.
Yeah.
But
you say all those same things to Elizabeth Shue at the start of Leaving Las Vegas. which is a memory I can never forget, the cutting.
This kind of feeds into my next question, because I've always noticed, especially in that film, that his blocking, it's very body-driven, which is weird. So just hearing the phrase, get your ass tight, that suddenly, and knowing that he's a dancer, like, for instance, the opening scene where the girl's on the boat, it's not even just spread your arms back.
No.
She's leading with her neck,
and
which is really peculiar.
Long before the Titanic, when she's in the prow.
Yeah.
His sense of choreography of the flow of wardrobe, the costumes, hair. These are things which meant a lot to him. And he, because he's so explosive, he doesn't sometimes get the credit for being as delicate as he was. I loved Ken. And I had there been the opportunity for something, I would have certainly worked with him again. It's always nice to work with the director again, because there's a sort of shorthand. You mentioned Leaving Las Vegas.
Because you worked with Vegas
seven times.
Okay, yeah.
On seven.
Oh, wow. I knew Time Code and that. What other?
Well, Time Code, certainly. I had a small part in the film he did with Wesley Snipes and Anastasia Kinski called, and I forget, Robert Downey.
Yeah. We'll look it up.
Yeah, pull it up.
Yeah.
I did a film in Venice with him based on Webster's Duchess of Malfi, but the story was the film crew making that.
Oh, I know what you're on.
Stayed in a hotel which was run by vampires,
and
we would slowly eat our way through the crew. So,
well, he grew to have an even more different approach, right? With very experimental and how he was mounting things. I assume a lot of improv when I'm watching things like Time Code.
Yeah, for sure. Time Code was written like a musical score rather than, because it's so important, where those cameras were to experience the cubist presentation. I mean, one take for all the cameras in sync. And so whatever we did, we tried to follow a sort of pattern, but it was always different.
Is it just clarity? I mean, in terms of, because when you have all these great directors, they're obviously such different personalities, but is it ultimately clarity of vision that they know what they want is what it brings you, draws you in?
For sure, yeah. Because if they're interesting and if they're excited about the material and if they are animated and charged, that means I'm going to be animated and charged. Mm-hmm. At the moment, here in Los Angeles, I can reveal to you and to your listeners, I'm making a film written and directed, one of the cameras operated by and appearance from the one and only Glenn Danzig.
You're in the new Danzig movie. That's awesome.
It's not just a Western. It's a spaghetti Western with a vampire twist. And if I tell you, it's untitled, so I can't tell you what it's called. But it's wonderful actors in it, Devon Sawa. And if I tell you I play a character called the Count, you'll get a flavor.
Okay. Ah.
Darren Richardson is a British actor who is remarkable as a character called Duke von Wayne, it's because of Glenn's kind of entity, his essence. That's what made me very excited to be a part of the untitled Glenn Danzig spaghetti Western with a vampire twist.
Wow. Were you familiar with his music before working with him?
Well, I can't say I was a devotee, but I was familiar with it because I've become more familiar with it in the last couple of few weeks. Of course, he's done the score, but I've been watching him on YouTube.
I think the idea of Julian Sands at a Misfits concert is like the coolest thought in my mind, so I would love to see that. One Night Stand was the name of that film. Yeah.
One Night Stand, exactly.
That was the clips, yeah.
And the Browning version, and then a couple of smaller films in England. But Figgis, I mean, a maestro, for sure. One of the few directors I've worked with who can really do anything on the set, whether it's the camera, the lights, the water. I mean, Ken Russell could do that. David Fincher certainly does that. But generally, directors these days tend not to be so all-embracing. Mm-hmm. It's much more compartmentalized.
Mm. Yeah.
Interesting.
Glenn Danzig, it's all embracing.
Self-taught. Exactly. Well, I'm curious about, because most of us, I actually think I saw Gothic before Warlock, but Warlock, I mean, I think there's an interesting thing about an actor that I'm always curious about who has such a diverse career, especially you almost start almost as a romantic lead, mm-hmm. and as soon as somebody's cast as a villain, that does well, and the villain in this case can also have a romantic side, but it often becomes the thing they often get offered, right? Cushing and Lee, Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing were two. So I'm love to hear how you got cast in that. I think that film was a big deal to a lot of us at the right age. Because it was exciting. It was a throwback, and then it was very 80s and exciting.
It had some gory elements to it. Yeah. There were some pretty cool effects in it. And it was unlike anything else I was really seeing in the 80s.
We were of the video store generation, so that is like we were at the right age renting that movie, and it's like Warlock. Awesome.
It's very gratifying to hear you say that. I mean in terms of casting, it's true. If an actor has some success with one particular kind of role, then that's what they
people
get
think
off.
Of you as. Yeah.
But that's one of the reasons I was so keen to do this because I was being offered lots and lots of more and more insipid romantic leads.
Very British, very British romantic
kind of, leads. They all came more and more like sort of chocolate box commercials. Yeah. And they didn't. And then suddenly here was this real Baroque villain. It could be Shakespearean, the Warlock. And I saw the potential, I felt, for tremendous style, elegance, chic, and humor, as well as this absolute sort of diabolical bird of prey-like path through the bones of the living.
Mm-hmm.
To it was. I remember too. I was filming in Eastern Europe, in Poland, when the communists were still in power. Solidarity had been crushed by, it was such a bleak, cold time because there was no money for any heating. And so suddenly this script shooting in California over the winter. So, and I liked it. And David Tui, who did the script, has to be given great credit.
Yeah.
Now, when I was sent it, I was told Sean Connery was playing the witch hunter, Redfern. And I thought that
Richard E. Grant
did he was fantastic. He's a very, very good actor.
Yeah.
But I was told Sean Connery.
Is that, and you'll probably find this amusing now, when I was young and I watched this movie, the way they make Richard E. Grant look bigger, I grew up thinking, he's this hulking stud of a man. And then you watch him now, it's like with Nail and I, and you go, oh, wow. Yeah. So, in fact, you guys are similar in types, really. I could imagine you both going for the warlock role.
It was just offered to me and I was happy to do it. And also, I was contracted for Warlock 2 at the time. They did a third, but...
I did not even know that till now.
Well, I'm telling you, they did a third, but instead of thinking, this is a great character, great story, let's really make it better and bigger. Yeah. It could be a breakout audience, a much wider audience, much more enduring.
Yeah.
But they instead, like happens with genre films sometimes, they decided, well, we've had some success with that, so let's make this for $50 and get whose brother can do a script and let's shoot it over a weekend. And it was absolutely of no interest to me, and I had no...
Now, let me just say, you had one of the... I mean, Warlock 2 isn't, it's hard to hold up to Warlock 1, but the ending of your character in Warlock 2, you have a pretty incredible finale in terms of practical effects and genre.
So. And, of course, those films both were made in the days of practical effects.
Yeah.
I mean, and, God, I had to swallow so much of that black goo.
It's so gross. It is one of the goopiest endings I've ever seen.
Yeah, well, the goop. I think I got paid danger money.
Oh, good.
We skipped over chronologically going when we jumped to Warlock.
We jumped like life. We jumped like a Nicholas Rogue film. We jumped through time.
There were two major ones there. Arachnophobia.
Arachnophobia.
Oh, yeah. Talk to me about some spiders, man.
The great thing about arachnophobia, I don't have arachnophobia. I don't either.
I own tarantulas. I find them cute.
But neither did the character. You're the doctor.
Yeah, I was Dr. Atherton. Yeah. And it was, Spielberg produced, Frank Marshall directing, and we were shooting on location in the Venezuelan highlands. Conan Doyle's The Lost World was based on those flat-top mountains. And
so you actually did go to Venezuela to shoot that opening part.
Absolutely.
That's phenomenal.
And it wouldn't happen today. But it was a very, coming mostly from independent film to sort of the power of studio film.
Oh my gosh. Now that would be in the palm tree farm out in San Fernando.
If you're lucky. Yeah. More likely someone's garden. But so that was but I liked to write. One of the things I hear a lot from people when I meet them is that they know about the film, they wanted to see it, but they didn't because they have arachnophobia. And it just creeped them out. But
everybody seems to know about it.
Yeah. Charming.
Yeah, no, it is. In that Spielberg way. As a Spielberg dish, for sure.
And again, really, top cast.
Yeah. Were those real spiders that were crawling all over you for your death scene?
You know what? They were. And when I talk about danger money, because to get the shot, when they started putting them on, of course, they all started running away. So they had to give me this sort of mask, like a fencing mask, with a tube coming out of it. It looked like a beak. So that when I was lying down, this was vertical. And they would drop all the spiders down the tube. So for a while, I had you know, maybe 200 spiders, each of them with eight legs running around in my mouth. Blah, blah, blah. But I just went into a Zen place. And then when they had the cameras rolling, an AD would pull the mask away and they'd finally get
the
shot.
Spiders did, I'm sure they didn't tell you what type of spiders they used, but I'm so intrigued.
I think they were brown recluse.
I don't. Oh, okay. You'd look a lot different now.
I thought some of that was filmed in New Zealand, but I just remember the spiders were being bred there at some point. That was when I was growing up. Yeah. There, that was a story that they had gotten loose. I don't know if it's true or not to this day.
I think if you live in certain parts of Culver City, then maybe
they're still running around those parts. And then the other one that I really wanted to ask about from right around that same time period was Naked Lunch.
Ah, yeah, Cronenberg. And what an interesting thing to hang out with Cronenberg. And
Was Burroughs around at all for the show?
Yes, he was.
Oh,
was.
Oh my gosh.
And I'd met him before because he was also an artist. Yeah. And an art gallery run by a man called Earl McGrath had given him a show, and we'd had dinner there at the gallery a couple of years before. But meeting Burroughs, it was a bit like meeting an undertaker for the Addams family. I mean, he did have, of course, his reputation preceded him, but if you didn't know anything about what he'd written or how he'd lived, you would get a very peculiar sensation on the back of your neck.
Well, and that voice too, like old Western movie.
Yeah, exactly.
I've heard poetry he does, and it sticks with you. It's terrible.
If he was still here, I'm sure he would be doing narrations for Blumhouse Productions.
had you read? Because I read Naked Lunch was not an easy book to read. Like
nope.
It's so ideas based, and it loses you. Obviously, the way he claims he was in a drug induced hallucination when he wrote, he doesn't remember writing it, he says. So I was always super impressed that Cronenberg could almost merge. It basically feels like a biography of Burroughs somehow merged with the story.
I think Cronenberg's adaptation and the way he made that film was an extraordinary enhancement and fulfillment of Burroughs' literary blueprint.
Yeah.
And I saw the film a couple of years ago, and I was so shocked at how subversive and undermining the film is. It would never get made today. Oh, it would just be regarded as too weird, too threatening.
The sexuality is so fluid and strange.
So just vaginal the whole time.
And of course, it was sensual and beautiful, but very disturbing.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, wow.
Well, I mean, especially guys like, I mean, somebody you wouldn't expect to kind of deconstruct masculinity is like Roy Scheider. To me, Roy Scheider is this ultimate beacon of like male masculinity. And in that, suddenly they're ripping off masks. The gender's in question. There's a lot of homoerotic overtones throughout. It's really, it's a bonkers piece of work. And yet it feels super, super heady at the same time. It's fascinating.
And you know, when we're talking about genre films, and of course, the films I like are, I suppose, what would be called more psychological. Things like The Others, Rosemary's Baby, Let the Right One. And even, you know, Midsommar.
Which you could have been in.
And it's,
you got the good look for it.
And it's forebear, The Wicker Man. I'm not such a fan of, you know, what you're wearing a Fangoria t-shirt of the kind of slaughter, torture.
Fangoria covers all of it. Just so
okay. but when I was working with Dario Argento,
we were very interested to hear about.
So Phantom of the Opera. Questions there as well.
Il Fantasma dell'Opera,
which is getting a Blu-ray release. I just read yesterday.
Oh, who's doing it?
It's a Scorpion Ronin Flex.
Nice.
That's coming out, I think, early next year.
I've been told that, and but you know, working with him was really like being with the most ascetic, priestly person. That he wasn't sort of crazy and driven by blood and gore and wounds. Right. He was very, very meticulous and considered a real poet, not as one might expect. I like The Witch, which was
Robert Eggers. Yeah. No, but Argento, you when you see that work, people can call these people, oh, they're like maniacs because they like to put their own hands. But then you watch The Artistry, and it's like there's so much craft.
Yeah.
I mean, and for horror, he's probably got the most craft.
Yeah.
Next to what Brian De Palma or one of these directors, it's the color and the camera. But how difficult – how is he with actors? Because I've never really heard from an actor perspective being directed in such a technical –
Well, because they always say he doesn't really speak English very well.
Yeah.
So even in terms of a communication.
It's true. And we were shooting in English, and Asia did speak English. Mm. He would he speaks a little English, but the script was there. And he was able to communicate enough, and he had an AD translator, an assistant a translator. But he was very specific, very about what he wanted in a scene, and because of that he'd constructed his shot, what the parameters were. But then within that, he was happy for us to be very free. He wasn't inhibiting by the meticulousness of what he wanted. And that's a gift. Mm-hmm. Rats. We had rats.
That's right.
I asked for some danger money.
Oh, you did? I like this danger money time. I've never heard this topic.
I didn't get any.
Oh, okay.
Or do rats pose a danger? I guess they could bite you.
Well, the psychological damage could have been irreparable because whereas I love spiders, if there is a rather like Winston Smith in 1984, I kind of gag a bit at rats.
Because it's about dirt. It's dirty. It's a, it's,
are rats dirty?
Something.
It's not the so black much, plague.
I don't know. My mom, we had a pet rat, so I never even thought of them as dirty.
I had my brothers and I, we had all kinds of things in the menagerie, including pet rats. But these things, which look wild and big and brown with teeth, it's the Willard thing. So, that was a challenge.
Wow.
How much when you go very dark in a role, and I know every actor's different. I imagine with the theater training, it makes it easier to turn it on and off. But I'm thinking of like, and I was joking about leaving Las Vegas, but actually, I for one think that is an utterly brilliant movie, and I think your role in it, whilst it might be small, is when I think of the film, I actually think of that because it really sets up the darkness that she's had to survive. You're her pimp, for those not listening, you're her pimp, and it opens with you using something I'd never seen, but I have heard since is very common with pimps, which is the cutting of somebody in a place that is less seen to control them. And I think you're cutting her butt, her ass or something, Elizabeth Shue, but it's such a dark scene, and he's such a dark character. How much of that, because you're obviously, you have to draw from things that are with him, but how easy is it to shake some of these kind of characters for you at this stage?
Well, with the character of Yuri on Leaving Las Vegas, and we were filming in Laughlin, Nevada, a little bit in Vegas it was, I find that whole gambling scene so depressing. Mm-hmm. And that, I know that Vegas in the last 20 years has become this sort of resort.
Yeah.
But at that time, I found it full of tremendous sadness. Mm-hmm. And I fortunately don't have a gambling gene. I'm not into cards or slot machines or horses. And I found the loneliness of Yuri, the character, so infecting of me. It was a sad and difficult period for me, and I couldn't shake off this great cloud until we'd wrapped and I'd come back to LA or gone on wherever I was going. Sometimes a project requires a depth of commitment, a density of involvement, which does become overwhelming. I mentioned the Czech Republic earlier. I did this adaptation of The Painted Bird.
Recently, right?
Yeah, and it's the Czech nomination. It's from Jerzy Kaczynski's book.
It's one of the most bleakest and incredible books I've ever read in my life.
And the film doesn't pull its punches, but it's a film of. However relentless is that bleakness, it's a film of immense beauty, too. It's, for those listeners who aren't familiar, it's the story of a young boy looking for his family at the end of the Second World War through the hinterland of Eastern Europe, which was lawless and ravaged. And it's how he goes from one person to another on his odyssey. And some of the people treat him well, and some of the people are not the people you would want your child to end up with. And
it's black and white, right?
And shot on film. Mm. One of the few films these days which was made on 35mm widescreen, black and white. And it's nearly 3 hours long. But the 3 hours flashes by. It's extraordinary how when something is really absorbing at a very high artistic level, how easily one is drawn in to the story. It's like...
Well, time is irrelevant in films because people complain about movies being long or short, but is the movie good or not? You forget the time.
Yeah, quite. Totally. Exactly.
I do know with Kaczynski that a lot of the observations of what happens to Boy in that were actually based on Roman Polanski's childhood when he was escaping the Nazi Germany and because they were good friends.
Yeah. There was a certain amount, I think, taken from those conversations, certain amount of his own experience, certain amount of invention to create this, and I don't mean to offer a pun, but this Grimm's fairy tale of a view of that world. And the thing is, although it's specifically set at the end of the Second War, it is very, very contemporary. Mm. It's incredibly of our time. What a cautionary tale. I would urge everybody listening to try and the IFC
have
bought it, so they'll be putting it in some theaters early next year, and but then they'll be streaming it. Harvey Keitel, Barry Pepper, Stellan Skarsgård. Very interesting cast.
Because it's amazing. Somewhat episodic.
It's episodic. Yeah. One story leads to the next.
On that kind of same note, though, like of being able to shake characters, what was the hardest character or most rewarding character in terms of like having to not necessarily always getting it straight away, working for it, and then discovering it, and then living in that skin for a while.
Other than a nasty piece of work.
Well, it could be anything, whatever it is.
Because a nasty piece of work, it was a great pleasure to, be this person. But I think I did a film with the Taviani brothers in Italy called Il Sole Anche di Notte, The Sun Also at Night, or the Night Sun, I think, in the English version.
Yes, The Night Sun.
Based on
a
Tolstoy short story with Nastasia Kinski.
Oh, wow.
And it's about the story of a man, a soldier who loves a woman who leaves him for somebody else, so he becomes a priest. And then when he sees her in church one day, he becomes a hermit in the mountains just to try and deny the world and exist only for prayer, and then she comes to him so it's the story of temptation and redemption. That was 3 months alone as this character, and that was, that would, in terms of immersion into an experience at a completely holistic way, that would probably be, because I was living up in the mountains in my little anchorite's hut, it is something of a cult film in Europe to those who are familiar with the Taviani
I'm familiar
cinema.
With them, but I haven't seen that film.
Okay,
that sounds really...
Night Sun.
Yeah, Well, segueing to cult cinema because it's sitting here. It was obviously – what's interesting about some – I think it's Leonard Maltin says you really can't judge a film at all for at least – or is it Joe Dante? One of them took it for at least 5 years. You can, maybe 10, maybe even 20 before you can even decide whether a film was any good. And I think, you know, Boxing Helena had so much controversy around just the casting and the lawsuits and production that people then forget about what the actual piece – that's being created, and it was obviously David Lynch's daughter's first movie, Jennifer Lynch. What was that experience
and she,
like?
Just, and she's gone on to be she's an incredible really director, yeah. Especially in TV.
She's doing incredible TV work.
She's really shown her chops, and as I believe she did with Boxing Helena, that, you know, as you rightly say, at the time of its making and at the time of its release, there was a great deal of controversy around the first, it was going to be Madonna, then it was going to be Kim Basinger yeah. And then she pulled out, and therefore
Sherilyn Fenn.
Came on, and I wasn't aware of all the controversy. Yeah. I read the script and thought, this is the most fascinating, beautiful.
It almost feels like a Ken Russell idea.
Oh my gosh, yeah, it does.
Kind of,
it's
quite
so
Ken Russellian, but also a kind of fairy story too. I mean, a real parable for the way we live. And I was very keen to be involved. When the film – and we made the film in this house outside Atlanta. And it had a romantic and sexual frisson throughout in a way that was beguiling and deeply romantic. And never did it occur to me that it was exploitative or somehow
tawdry or something.
Yeah, tawdry or ignoble. Mm-hmm. You know, it seemed to me to be a very interesting piece of art. And yeah, when it came out, it was. People were so derisory, so dismissive, so contemptuous and rude and belittling, and it was tough. It was fortunately, you know, I was able to go. I had other things to do, but Jennifer really.
She was super young, right? She was like 19 or 20.
20, yeah. And wow. And showed such spirit, and have you know. Her father wasn't on set helping out. She was doing it herself because she had learned how to be a filmmaker as growing up. And I felt, you know, but it was, I think a lot of that ill will was generated by the people involved with the Basinger lawsuit.
Yeah, right.
I think there was,
basically not to do with the art.
Not to do with the art, not to do with the film, but a certain amount of agendas, other people's agendas for issues which had nothing to do with the project.
Mm. That's all I could think about.
But it does endure because people watch this today and for the first time and are kind of thrilled by it. And
what it is crazy. It feels crazy.
And how contemporary. Yeah. And to bring up the issues of today, I mean, and I'm glad you said that about, you know, a film endures if it has quality. And sometimes it's not clear till 10 or 20 years later just what kind of impact.
So they did make. A Boxing Helena panel at Texas Frightmare 2 years ago.
Oh, yeah, with Jennifer,
With Jennifer, and I rewatched it right before that, and when The Perfection hit Netflix just this past year, it kept reminding me of that, because it's beautifully shot. It is this beautiful, classy orchestration with this absolutely abhorrent subject matter, and somehow they kind of combine into this fascinating viewing, but yeah, it feels more of its time now than when I first saw it.
Yeah, I'm glad you say that.
Well, and that, it's cult. That's, I guess, that word cult, right? When these movies do find an audience finally. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's nice to. But I mean, hard for the actor, though, because an actor's career does deal with one film leading to the next. So
if you're
takes
lucky,
20 years,
yeah, sure. But you know, that's snakes and ladders.
Right.
I mean, And when I said, you know, I have no interest in gambling, I mean, like, some degree, my whole career has been a gamble.
Makes sense, yeah. The one other director that we definitely wanted to find out, because I've always heard he's, again, perfectionist, David Fincher, you know, with the American remake of Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. You're part of the, that family.
Yeah. Well, Finch, I mean, I always liked his film. So when I was asked to play the young Heinrich, I think it wasn't who did play me? Who was the...
Well, Stellan's in there.
Who's the older Heinrich? Christopher Plummer.
Oh, Plummer. Yeah.
So Plummer. I was hired to be the young Christopher Plummer.
Right, that's right.
I was hired to be the young. It was going to be the Swedish actor
Max von Sydow.
Max, who I had worked with, so I knew him a little bit, and I said, I'd be mad as a Max. You know? Yeah. He said, oh, no, I don't know if I do this. And, of course, he didn't do it. Yeah. Christopher Plummer did it. But the sort of the casting match still worked. And what impressed me so much about Fincher was how caring he was about every aspect and how every element that goes into a frame and goes into supporting the recording of that frame mattered to him. So we could have the most intense conversation directed to actor, but then he'd be over just, you know, fluffing a curtain the way it was falling or rearranging the flowers.
Ah.
And then possibly going over to change the lights, saying to the DP, you don't mind, do you? And this reputation he has for, you know, many, many takes is based on his enthusiasm and his understanding that it's only through reduction and repetition that things can free up. If you want to do 50 takes, great. because I like being an actor and I like physically and intellectually, emotionally doing it. But I know that, you know, some people do grumble if they do a couple of takes and it seems to be right for them. Why are we doing this again? Mm-hmm. Let's move on. You know, no, we're doing it because it's groovy.
So, part of it's the search, right? Obviously Kubrick was accused of the same thing, but everyone I've met who I ever have gotten to ask about, they're always, because he's looking for a very specific thing until he finds he's not going to stop.
May not necessarily know what it is he's looking for, but he knows... People, they know when they have something, but then they have the means to continue the search for something they don't know. Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, I'm all for that. I love that search in a film, within a performance, within a way it's shot and lit, within the way it's set. Where it's set.
Is there a type of role you haven't gotten to play at this point in your career that you just are curious and would love to? I mean, there's obviously a lot of things.
Or a type of film, like the one thing you've always wanted to do.
Is there an itch?
The itch is to continue working with interesting people on interesting projects, because therefore my life's interesting. But the reason I can't – actors, when it comes to work, generally are reactors. Mm. You know, you react to what you're asked to do and where you're taken and who you're put with and who directs you. Mm. So it's a reactive process. When you do a job, you might never have conceived the idea of doing it, but once you're doing it, it so often feels utterly inevitable that it seems totally random, totally by chance, but then when you're doing it, oh yeah, this is what was meant to be. I would, you know, if we'd met at the time of filming a nasty piece of work, I would have never. And you'd said, "What do you?" I would never have said, "Well, I want to do the Glenn Danzig untitled spaghetti western with a vampire twist." But doing it feels absolutely where I was, what I was meant to be doing next.
Now, can we ask questions about the Glenn Danzig vampire western?
You can ask, but whether or not I can answer is another thing.
I probably can't answer on content.
I have questions. So can you give us a kind of the details of your character?
He called it
no,
the Count.
No, he told us what the name was.
The Count. Okay, that's all we get right now.
We don't want to get him in trouble.
Yeah. Oh, I know, I know.
I don't want Glenn Danzig after
totally
him
intrigued.
Or
no,
us.
We don't want Glenn Danzig after you, well, but I totally want info.
I want to see you work with, because I think I love the way he reinvents people's personas, is Ben Wheatley, the British director.
Oh, my gosh,
that's somebody
yeah.
I just could see you in one of his visions. So in case somebody's listening, visions. Who knows Ben,
yeah.
let Ben know.
Ben Wheatley, call Julian, we'll set it up. It's cool.
I'm very open. And the thing is, that is so often how you know somebody has an idea and they oh that could be and then it becomes inevitable once you put the two people or the ideas together. I did a film in Mumbai, India, earlier this year, which is a sort of cross between Slumdog Millionaire and Billy Elliot.
Was that the Garden Mists one?
Garden of the Evening Mists. No, that was in Malaysia.
Oh, thank you.
That was
Jet Setter.
And another thing. But this one, I play a ballet teacher, and I was the only Western actor or part of the crew. It was such an authentic and fascinating story of a slightly washed up. Ex-ballet dancer who's now a teacher who can only get a gig teaching in Bombay, but finds two young dancers, male dancers of such, who are so gifted, he knows if he really works with them, he can bring them up to international level. And by committing to that, he sort of redeems himself. I think Netflix have bought it. Well, I know they have, so they'll have it next year.
Mm. Not a question, but just something cool I wanted to bring up. You've worked with so many
anything since we're such old friends.
I just want everyone to know that one of the coolest things that Julian ever did was about 10 years ago, you probably don't know this, on the show Smallville. Okay. He played Jor-El.
Oh.
He was Superman's dad.
Superman's dad.
Oh, my
Following gosh. Following the footsteps of Brando. There you go.
Exactly. I thought it was so cool when you got cast as Jor-El in that show.
Yeah.
It totally makes sense, though.
I loved my time shooting with them. And the first scene with Tom, the first
Tom
episode
Melling,
was very much with I found it so emotionally rich and real. And for a sci-fi-ish show. That was a great revelation. He led that show in a very committed way. Impressed me.
And
Laura, the wife, was Helen Slater, who was the original superhero.
Yeah, true.
So that was just cool casting all around.
You mean Billie Jean?
Well, I have a quick question about one of the smaller films that is kind of a deep cut, but I love it, Witch Hunt, which is the sequel to Cast a Deadly Spell.
Yeah.
And I had always been a huge fan of Cast a Deadly Spell, and so I hunted down Witch Hunt, which has an amazing cast. It's like Dennis Hopper and Eric Bogosian and you. Yeah. And what was Dennis like to work with?
We became quite Paul pally.
Schrader. Yeah, Paul Schrader. It's like a ridiculously awesome cast.
Yeah, Paul Schrader had written it and as well as directing it. I like Dennis. I knew him a little bit, again, from this gallery in West Hollywood, the Earl McGrath Gallery. Earl was a great kind of host and would have soirees of like-minded and people.
Because Dennis is kind of became known as one of the major collectors of American art, right?
Major collector, but also a wonderful photographer. Mm. So he had his own record of the American way of life. We also, we did a gig in Tokyo together for Comme des Garçons and Yoshi Yamamoto doing the runway for their collection with some other interesting John Laurie, Edgar Broughton, and John Malkovich.
So, like a fashion line?
Yeah, fashion.
Interesting.
Wow. Yeah, Yoshi Yamamoto. So there's a long flight to Tokyo.
Yeah.
I got to know Dennis quite well.
Yeah.
Awesome and interesting and very professional when we work together.
That's awesome.
Witch Hunt.
Mm.
Very cool. I recommend that for any of our listeners who haven't seen it. It's a trip. Like,
I want to check that out now.
Cast a Deadly Spell was fun, but I always liked Witch Hunt a little
bit.
There
you go. Yeah, and that came from Rebecca without any prompting.
None. Which
that
one?
Was genuine.
She hasn't written down on many.
I did. I wrote it down as one of the ones I had to talk about. I also wrote down Million Dollar Hotel, which I was going to hold off on because it's not a horror film. But I fucking love that movie.
Yeah.
It was so huge for me. Came out right as I was finishing high school, going into college. And it was one of those that I watched in repetition right as like an early first year film student. It's so good.
Yeah. So. I mean, people, Wim Wenders is the director. And internationally, a huge auteur. And people might know Wings of Desire.
Well, here, you talked about Natasha Kinski earlier. Paris, Texas is just a masterpiece.
Yeah. Masterpiece.
Yeah, I love that film. But you know, those are, again, these directors. What I like is that they all, you can see their clarity of vision, but they all are such different personalities from the people you were. I mean, going from Ken Russell to Argento to Wenders is, seems like huge leaps, but, you know, I imagine there's some unifying thing there.
Well, I think, you know, some, artistry, a striving for their own vision, whether it's high art or low, whatever it is, they have a point of view, a need, a desire to express themselves in the way which is appropriate to them.
And
it's exciting to work with people who are driven and have a vision.
Before we wrap up, I wanted to bring up a story that we did off air, but you had the executive producer on A Nasty Piece of Work is Jason Blum, who we're in his building right now.
Yes.
But you said you met him pretty early in his career.
Yeah.
Is that correct? What was that?
Well, it was on – I met Jason first when he was the producer of a film called Easy Six, in which I played an English professor – going to – Hugh Grant should really have played this role, but I was playing. And going to Las Vegas to give a lecture at a convention called Milton Mania. Because and whilst there, this hapless professor, I fall in with a showgirl. And we end up with then we get married at the Elvis Chapel, and Elvis is played by.
Well, it's not Nick Cage. We know
it's
that.
I'm pulling it up right now. It
chances
looks like
are decent that it could
Jim
have been.
Belushi.
Jim Belushi.
Oh,
yeah.
Jim Belushi. That's enough.
And Vicious Stevens was in it. I think. Playing a. Anyway, it was this very charming, touching. In which, too, Kyle Howard, who is in A Nasty Piece of Work, played a small role. So it was nice to see him again. And it had its life the way things do. I won the Best Actor Award at the California Independent Film Festival. you can't have enough doorstops as looking around this room.
Yes, we have lots
we
of them in this office.
Testify.
You're surrounded by the statues.
But is it usually Warlock? Like when you meet people at conventions or places throughout your career, the last 20 years, is it usually Warlock that people lead with? I'm always just curious, what is the thing?
Or arachnophobia.
It depends on the demographic.
Yeah.
Okay.
If I go somewhere where there's likely to be a gathering who
are fan types,
then possibly Warlock. Room with a View still quite a lot. Some people who are more current might be Girl with the Dragon Tattoo or even Ocean's 13, Soderbergh. Or Jor-El, or I did this TV thing called Stargate.
And
Sci-fi
always
Stargate's
has huge
massive.
Fan bases,
And I'm always very touched when I've done a lot of films in Europe, and when people have seen something of those. The great thing about today and the industry we're working in is the opportunity for people to see work which in the past they might only have been dependent on it playing in a small cinema somewhere. But now with streaming, It's a revelation.
Yeah,
and even that, it's bringing up older stuff too. Because after, and this is, I saw you in it recently, but it's an older show. After I finished Black Sails, which I fucking loved and binged through, yeah. It brought me to Crossbones.
Okay,
and you were in that as
yes,
well.
Yes, I was. So, yeah. No. So I'm. Sometimes you hear grumbling from actors about streaming and how it doesn't serve the material as well as a big cinema screen. Listen, if people are watching, it's serving. You know, that's my
belief. Well, it's taking the pressure off theatrical, having to make money theatrically for some types of films, which is good. They're, you know, it's changing it all.
Yeah. I mean, only some types of films are ever going to make money theatrically. Yeah. For the rest, it's just advertising. Mm-hmm. You know, I think we're all very, very lucky to be working whatever way in this entertainment industry.
Definitely. It's been really fun to hear your passion for what you do. It's really exciting. Yeah. So we appreciate
well,
it.
Well, thank you. No, my pleasure to come in and sit with you. When the untitled Glenn Danzig. Yeah.
Yes, bring Glenn back with you.
Well, we'd love to have you and Glenn on together.
That would be a ride.
And Hulu, your Hulu episode Streets on the same day as this episode.
Right now, you can watch A Nasty Piece of Work on Hulu right now. And so it's a lot of fun. It was great seeing you, Julian. Thanks for coming.
Thank you. And can I say to everybody listening, tune in to A Nasty Piece of Work and enjoy it.
Yeah. Enjoy its deliciousness.
Yes. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.